Hello and welcome to this week's Indie Radio Garden. We're very happy to share with you highlights from community radio in the Philadelphia region.
This program brings ordinary citizens to the air to discuss issues related to health, race, safety, workers' rights, and the will to survive in pandemic times.
This week, our producers share very personal stories. First, we start with Porch Talk. Connie Belay of WRLG of 92.9, Germantown Life Enrichment Center, speaks with her 90-year-old father about childhood and family memories just after the passing of her mother.
I recorded this conversation with my dad sitting on the porch on Winona Street. He was in his 90s. His mom had died. My brother had died. And we were talking about his childhood, about the family, about family love and family conflict, the things that you talk about when you're sitting on the porch while your neighbor is fixing his porch roof and your neighbor's other neighbors are walking by. Hope you enjoy it.
Tell me a story. You know, it's a good story about the boys' club.
We had a club amongst little kids, you know, 10, 12, 13. And we went to the store, and it was like a clubhouse. So it was like $15 a month or something like that. Saturday morning, we had a meeting. And I was supposed to do the floors for Mama or something, do something, wash her window. And she came out, she didn't see me. She came walking down the block and she says, "Has anybody seen where Sally is?" So Stevie told her I was in the store down the corner. She came running down and she grabbed me. She grabbed me out. Beat me. Boom, boom, boom.
Your brother ratted you out.
Knocked me around.
Yeah, but your brother told on you.
I know. I get even with him.
I thought he was a member of the club, though.
But he was too young then. I was 12, he was 6.
Oh.
Mama made me take him over.
You tell the story about when he made him take you to camp.
She made me take him all over. He was 6 and a shit ass baby. She made me take him to camp.
I'm sorry, you were 12 and he was 6?
So I said to Mom, he can't go there because all the kids are 12 and he's 6. What's he going to do with us? She said, "You take him or you can't go."
This is the Boy Scout camp?
Boy Scout.
The Boy Scouts let him go? He was only 6?
Well, it was your brother. They let you take your brother. You were responsible for him. Your mother wanted to send him.
So where was this Boy Scout camp? Maybe you didn't remember.
It was right out on the New York, New Jersey borderline. They had a place there.
Could it have been
it was year-round Boy Scout camp. And every troop, at a certain time during the summer, they could bring their kids up there. For 1 week, from Saturday to Saturday.
So what happened?
Well, he was a pain in the ass. One time, the cook said he'd make huckleberry pie if we would go and pick the huckleberries for him. It was huckleberry field. The other side of the lake. The lake wasn't too big. It was about a 75-foot, 100-foot lake. So a bunch of us got aprons with a tie-on apron and had a big pocket in the front. We took the apron, tied them on, we went over, we swam across. Then when the cook had given us the pin, safety pin, they had to pick the huckleberry root, shake the pin the top, and then swim back.
Oh, that way you wash the huckleberries and everything.
picking up your brother's nose and says to your son, "Zombie, zombie," like he was getting killed. What happened? "Oh, zombie, zombie." So you suddenly, so I didn't button my Huckleberry. I jumped in the swim across. That's what happened. He says, "Tie my shoe." It's the funny thing he told Mama when she came up to visit us. So he punched me.
Wow. Oh, so you got it all around. You got it because you didn't get the huckleberries. You didn't tie your shoe. You punched him, and then you got beat by your mother. You had a very hard childhood.
My mother never asked any questions. All he had to say, he hit me. Pow, pow. She never asked me why. Pow, pow, pow. She hit me over the head with a frying pan. Oh, bless you, across my head. She used to say to me, "You know, he can't hit you back, but I can." Oh.
Some people would say he has stories.
All my stories.
I want to hear
that story. She said, "Don't tell that one."
Oh. Right, why don't you? No, that's not the one for
exactly.
Now.
Exactly.
Yeah. Cut you off.
She pinched my leg so hard the car. My driver used to tell stories. He banged me. "What are you doing?" She said, "That's not the one."
Yeah, right.
Yeah, you'd vary it a little bit. In fact, you'd vary it midstream sometimes. That's not the one, Tom.
Sometimes you do that on purpose.
Did we get a punch from Marie? Oh, my wife is strong as a bull boy. When she punches, she punches.
Yeah.
I have plenty of black boot marks on my arm.
Well, is that because she punched hard or you were telling the wrong jokes?
Oh, and how?
You know it was your fault, right? But it's like, oh, well.
She always said to me, the day that she died, she said, "Everybody know who her boss was. I was the boss." She said, "I was the boss."
Was that what she said?
Yeah, you're right. Was she really the boss?
Yeah, she was the boss.
Yeah, she was quite a lady.
I don't know. Was
she the boss? My son was about 5 years old, 6 years old. He did something, and I said, "Listen, if you want to live in this house, you got to live under my rules." He said, "Well, I can live other places." "Yeah, where?" He says, "You want me to go?" I said, "Yeah." My mother lived out across the street.
Oh.
So I know where it was going.
Right.
So he says, "Ma, give me a bag. Give me a bag." Mama said, "What do you want a bag for?" She said, "I'm packing because I'm going to go live with Grandma." So she said, "Did your father say okay?" He said, "Well, I didn't ask him yet." So he gets a bag and he puts goulashes. So they put it in the bag with the goulash. And he never wore goulashes. He would never wear them. Put goulashes in the bag. He says goodbye to his mother.
He knew that was just another way to drive you crazy.
That's what so that cute.
He said goodbye to his mother, and then his mother says, "Well, what are you going to do to your father?" She says, "You better go kiss him goodbye." So he comes over to kiss me. I put my hand here, and I pulled all his clothes off in one shot. He said, "What are you doing?" I said, "When you came into this house, you came with no clothes. When you leave this house, you leave with no clothes." "I can't leave with no clothes."
That is classic. That is so cute. Now, that's the very kind of story I would hear on NPR on that show. Something just like that. Some wonderful story. You're driving along, or I'm cooking dinner, and you hear a story like that.
When Dan and Sarah and I went to Disney World, and as we got into Disney World, there was a boat concessionaire. But it was one of the remote control boats where you're standing up in the back. You have a remote control, and the little boat that your remote control works with is in the water down below you. And you can see the boat maneuver as you take your remote and move the remote back and forth. So Maceo, I said, "Would you like to play that?" He says, "Yeah, Grandpa." So put a quarter in the machine, and the boat starts to move around. He moves it around, I can tell by the look in his eye, he's really enjoying it. He gets the boat back in. But when I got to the dock, he still had time on it. So he put it out again. He put it out. Now it is time there now. He couldn't get the boat back. So he looks up at me with one of his little sheepish looks. And he says, "I'm not so good at this game before. I still got time, and now I ran out of time. I said, we'll put another quarter in. The second quarter, now he's got the ball way out there, and he ran out of time. So she's like, I haven't figured this out yet, Grandpa. He's another quarter. So this happened about 6 or 7 times now. Now he was so frustrated when I said, Grandpa, I said, don't worry, Michelle, he's another quarter. He looks up at me, he says, Grandpa, that's too many quarters, too many quarters. I said, you know how many quarters you're worth to me? How many? And I stretched my arms out. He says, how many quarters is that? I said, it's about 1 million. He says, well, how many quarters is 1 million? It's 1 million quarters. He didn't say another word. As soon as we got home to his house, he ran to Tim, his father, and he said, Dad, how many quarters is 1 million? And Tim says, well, who asked you a question like that? He says, nobody asked me the question, but I want to know how many quarters is there in 1 million. So Tim says, well, it's 1 million quarters. And Sarah said, no, how many? How many? Tim said, but it's 1 million. And he looked so frustrated that he couldn't figure out how many quarters 1 million was.
Oh, my grandfather. He was a big man, boy. Wow. 6'3". And he was such a big man. He was able to pick me up like this with his hands and lift me off the ground.
By your head?
By my head. Right around my head and just pick me up like that.
Lucky the head didn't come off the body. It must have been little.
I was little. And he had false teeth, uppers and lowers. You should take him out at night and put him in water next to the bed. And I thought that was amazing. You could take your teeth out. So they said I was a big liar. So when my grandfather came, I said, Grandpa, show my friends how you think take your teeth out of them. So he gave me a smack. Pow! Don't tell anybody I take my teeth out.
Thank you, Connie, for sharing such sweet, funny, endearing family memories. Next, from WBEB 88.1 Scribe Radio's Community Correspondence Workshop, Lois Volta gives us a brave, highly personal, painful interview with Hannah on domestic violence during the midst of the pandemic. This first-person testimonial shares the effects of toxic masculinity and violence in a household.
Where did you meet this guy?
So in March, I went to New York for a concert. And I stayed with my friend
Perry,
lived in this communal live art space with 9 other people, hung out with
Perry.
And the night I was supposed to leave, I met
Tom,
who ran the house. We ended up hooking up, talking, came back to Philly, continued to talk, and he actually came to Philly and spent a week with me. The day before lockdown, he convinced me to go back to New York with him. So I spent the first 4 months of lockdown in this live-in art space with this person I didn't know and was now dating.
And at first it sounded super attractive. It was kind of like, all right, I'll get out of Philly, this new
lockdown with someone that I think I like. Yeah, it was great.
Could be romantic.
Could be.
When you moved up there, what was the vibe when you first moved in? You were sharing a room or?
We were sharing a room. The other roommates seemed pretty okay with me. I'm still friends with one of them.
What was the first signs that you saw things were going downhill with Tom?
And me personally?
Yeah.
Lots of drinking, control. I wasn't allowed to talk to the roommates, or if I did text them, I had to tell him what I was saying. He was trying to censor me. He was censoring me. And if something happened between the roommates and I wanted to confront it and try to form a relationship with them on my own, I had to show him what I was going to say or just not say anything at all.
Because you're his guest or because you're new or you don't like, did he like belittle you or like what made you
I think like, he was paranoid that I would make him look bad. So weird because you almost don't notice it when it's happening.
Because you feel like you're on the same team as someone.
Yeah.
And you want to believe them. And you're having fun together and you're being intimate.
Yeah, you want to be on their side, but at what cost to yourself?
When did it feel like it was starting to cost you something?
Just kept kind of pushing me, like, move in with me, move in with me. And it's like, well, I have a life in Philly. I'd only been in Philly for 6 months.
Yeah.
I have a room I'm paying for. I have a job that I'm hoping to get back to. And, like, my life, I just moved to Philly. I like you. I want to be with you. But do I actually want to be in New York? I think part of me deep down knew that it was a mistake from the beginning.
What was it that made you feel like this is starting to cross over to abusive behavior?
Well, the night I moved in, we're unpacking my things in his room. And prior to moving in, when I was back in Philly packing up all my stuff, I had asked him, like, will you, for my, like, peace of mind, let all of your girlfriends, buddies, whatever they are, just let them know that I'm moving in. You're in a monogamous relationship now. I'm literally uprooting my life for you. Like, let's just be transparent with the people in our lives. And that got him really mad. He didn't want to do it. He didn't think he had to do it. And to me, it's nothing. Like,
you were giving up the things that you'd spent the last 6 months building in Philly to do something for him, but something as simple as
transparency. He didn't like that. And he ended up pinning me against a wall. And that's when I called you the next day.
He, like, physically pinned you against the wall?
Oh, yeah. I had, like, black and blue bruises all over my body. Screaming, lots of screaming, yelling, getting in my face.
So it turned into you just saying, I just moved here to be with you. We're living in a group house, so there's a lot of people that are already here in our relationship. And I just want it to be me and you. We're in the middle of a pandemic. I just moved up here. And you wanting that transparency turned into an argument, which led to him being physically.
That was the first time and the scariest time. And I'm not sure if he actually remembers what he did. The next day after that happened, the roommates, so I ended up sleeping in a different room that night. The roommates insisted on getting me out of there. And
because they knew what happened
through the yelling, yeah. And sure enough, John weaseled his way back into my life and apologized and made all these promises that he would never do it again. He would stop drinking and da da da. Gave him the benefit of the doubt, and a month later, it all just kept happening.
Yeah, the fighting doesn't stop because you believe in it, especially when somebody who's so controlling kind of lets their guard down and says sorry and apologizes. It makes you see the person inside that you really do want to see, and you want to see get better, and you want to see get the help. And I don't know if this was the way it was for you, but for me, when I saw that in David, like, I see you. I see you in there. With all the crap gone, somebody who's, like, wants to be a better person, who wants to do the right thing, who's being vulnerable, saying that they're sorry. And then it just makes me love you even more because I know you've got it in you. So I believe in you. And it made me, like, believe in us.
By the time I moved out and got the restraining order, all of the roommates had moved out because
John
just got so abusive.
Yeah. I'm sorry that that happened to you.
So weird because you almost don't notice it when it's happening.
Because you feel like you're on the same team as someone.
Yeah.
And you want to believe them. And you're having fun together and you're being intimate.
Yeah, you want to be on their side. But at what cost to yourself?
What happened for me and how it started to get abusive was things would start happening in my life that I felt like were good. And
David
would downplay my intelligence. And he'd make me feel like I wasn't worthy or I was just stupid or I wasn't doing it right. And then I would start to get sad and depressed because I'm like, maybe I am messed up. Maybe I'm not doing it right. And I started really, like, it, which erode my self-esteem to a point where I was just getting really depressed. And then he would get angry at me that I was down because I wasn't strong enough. I wasn't brave enough. I wasn't doing all the things that I should be doing. And then I'd feel even worse about myself. And then we would get in an argument and I'd say, I just want you to be my friend. I want you to lift me up. I want you to, like, if you see these things in me, help me, encourage me, just love me through it. And he'd say things like, you know, well, that's not on me, that's on you. And our fighting would just start to get so bad. And if we had any drinks involved, it would get really, really bad. He'd really, really get angry. And there was one time I just ended up just crying and crying and crying. And he got so angry at me that he pinned me down to the floor and he put his knee on my neck and he was just screaming at me, shut up, stop it. You need to stop it right now. You're so fucking pathetic. And he was just like screaming at me and I'm bawling underneath him. And he's like a scary guy. I mean, he's like not a little guy. He's like a really strong guy. And I chalked that up to he just never was comforted when he was little. He never was, he doesn't know what to do when people have depression. He doesn't know what to do. And I forgave him. Then it started getting like worse. It was like since I forgave him and condoned that behavior, it what that did is it made it acceptable. And he would do it again. And there were times at the end, I was like, we would get in a fight and I would go hide under the bed. Mm-hmm. I would just be scared, just so scared of him. And it made me scared to have a bad day, because if I had a bad day, I was going to be told how stupid and dumb and how pointless I was. And everywhere else in my life, I'm like, I have this beautiful staff, I have like this business, I have amazing friends, I have like all this other stuff, like I have this great family, my kids are beautiful. Like, if I'm so terrible, why is everything else in my life beautiful? Mm-hmm. It's like, no, that's you,
not you. Yeah, it's,
and that's what felt like the biggest relief when he left, was like, I'm okay. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I just wonder if it's just the forgiving nature of women and the optimism that people have going into relationships.
I felt pretty stuck, to be honest, having no one in New York except
Tom.
It's a pandemic. I don't have a job, like relying on him financially. I don't have a car. I don't really have a place to live.
I remember.
It's kind of just, what do I do? I'm stuck there. I can fly home and leave all my stuff behind, but I have a cat.
But then it's in New York.
Yeah.
Or...
yeah. Very weird situation I put myself in.
Sometimes we put ourselves in those situations, though, and we know never to do it again.
Oh, I never want to sleep next to someone and feel so tense. Not a good feeling.
I don't know how many times I've cried myself to sleep saying, I feel really sad right now, will you just hold me? And him saying, you're pathetic, and just moving as far on the other side of the bed as possible and just starting to cry and just crying myself to sleep next to him. It's like, that's so messed up.
It is.
It's just like, give me a hug.
The coldness doesn't belong in a bed.
No. Something my dad would always say, he's like, never go to bed angry. Mm-hmm. And I think because of that, I'd always like try to work things out so we can have peace falling asleep. So at the end of the night, we know we still love each other. We may not have solved the fight or solved the argument, but at least we can get to a point where we can still lay in the same bed and be like, well, let's work on this a little bit more tomorrow. I love you.
Yeah.
That seems like a baseline. Like, we can be really angry at someone, but if we're choosing to live our lives sleeping next to each other, we should at least feel like that's worth the respect.
Yeah. I try to be a good communicator, and I think that was a thing with
Tom.
Just didn't know how to communicate, talk about problems, or even like the willingness to look for resolutions.
I think that you are a really good communicator. I wouldn't say that you're not a good communicator. What I would say is, and this is just what I see myself in you, I'm not saying that this is you, but when I hear your story and I hear things that we've talked about before, and what I struggle with is the self-respect to know that it's not okay for someone to treat you like that, or that I deserve someone who just wants to be nice to me. Mm-hmm. And like, I think that there's something went haywire in a relationship or my past, or I don't know what it was, that made me believe that an abusive relationship was enough, or it's going to be fine, or you could get through it, or you'll power through, or your love will be enough, instead of just like just right off the bat, you deserve to be with somebody who wants to communicate with you. You deserve to be with somebody who loves you. You deserve to be with somebody who makes you feel good. And it's like, for me, it turned into like more of a self-worth mm-hmm. issue.
Yeah. Would you say you've forgiven? You said you forgave
David? Yeah, because I don't trust him with my heart.
Yeah.
I don't trust him with my opinions. I don't trust him with how I feel, my feelings. I don't trust him with any of that. So I'm not going to give him any of that to hold.
Yeah.
But I don't want to live in resentment. I don't want to live in hate. And I know that hurt people hurt people. Mm-hmm. So when I see him around, which I'm going to see him around, it sounds kind of messed up, but I only want to see the good in him and the things that I like about him. But I think part of that is so I don't doubt myself and the reason that I did stay and the things that I did see that were really nice and the things that I did love about him. Mm-hmm. And I think me forgiving him actually gives me the value to trust the reasons that I made the decisions that I made. So I don't look back and think all the things like, Lois, you're stupid. You're like all the things that he said about me. When I can look back and be like, well, I really loved him and I loved this about him and we worked together in these ways so great. And these are all the reasons why it was so amazing and so wonderful. And yeah, there were ways that it was awful. But if I can just focus on the good stuff and take all the bad stuff and say, well, he just doesn't have access to me anymore. So there's no way for him to hurt me again mm-hmm. because I have my boundaries. Mm-hmm. Then, I don't know, it just frees up my emotional energy to love my kids more.
Yeah.
Or my friends more. And it's like, I hate walking around with hate in my heart.
Yeah, I agree with that. Though sometimes I feel like Tom doesn't deserve my forgiveness. You can't put your hands on me and that will never be okay. That will never be forgiven.
It's more about, to me, at least for me, it was more... like, I had to forgive myself that I put myself in that situation. And once I forgave myself, I could see that
David
had no idea what he was doing. He has control issues. Obviously, something went haywire with him. And we never really know why people do what they do. And, like, the little boy in him in there was somehow tragically hurt.
Yeah.
And it makes it a little bit easier to be like, I just don't need to be around you, but I'm going to forgive myself that I put myself in harm's way. And then when it comes to thinking about
David,
it's like, yeah, maybe he doesn't deserve to be forgiven, but there's plenty of things that I've done wrong that maybe I shouldn't be forgiven for, but I'm sure glad that I am. And that's like the balance of grace, right? It's like we give ourselves grace, but when we're gracious and merciful to people who don't deserve it, says more about us than it does the jerk who did the thing in the first place.
Thank you, Lois and Hannah, for sharing your stories. We want you to know, if someone you know is living with domestic violence, help is available. The National Domestic Violence Hotline is available 24/7. That phone number is 1-800-799-SAFE. 1-800-799-7233. Everyone deserves to be safe. And thank you for joining us this week in Indie Radio Garden. I'm Joanna Wykander, Program Director at G-Town Radio, and this is a Prometheus Radio Project.